Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
This week is all twisty, huh?
It is. It's a little bit different. We have a little different setup this week. We are practicing social distancing. So we are not in the same place right now, which is weird for us.
Right? We're just like, 15, 20 minutes away from each other, but we're trying to be responsible. So. Yes,
we are being responsible. We're doing our part.
Yes.
I'm drinking a kind of beer slushy because I forgot that I put this beer in the freezer.
So. Oh, nice. What beer slushy are you drinking? It's
a Veltins Pilsner.
Oh, very nice. That sounds like one that I would want to drink slushy.
It's nice. I mean, it's definitely better cold, which was my thinking in putting it in the freezer, but I didn't mean to leave it in that long. I just forgot about it.
Well, that's still, you made it good. So, hey, we've learned a lot from alcohol history that sometimes accidents are where the best things come from.
Yes, indeed. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking a bamboo cocktail. I feel like in the future when we're old and we're like, oh, back in the quarantine, like this will be my quarantine drink. The reason for it is that it's a low alcohol cocktail. It's like an equal mixture of like sherry and dry vermouth with some bitters.
Ooh, that sounds lovely.
It's my favorite thing in the world. I got turned on to it back when we could go to the theater back in the day. the Draft House always has them on their menu. So I got turned on to those there. And now it's become the thing that I drink. Like, I have rules about drinking when I'm off or when I'm trying to, like, be productive during the day, freelancing, whatever, doing commissions. So I don't start drinking till to a certain point of the day. And then I also try to drink low alcohol things.
Those are good rules. I start drinking at 4:30. I think that's when I start. No. I started drinking earlier today. Because I had some macaroni and I needed something to drink with it. So I started drinking beer at like 3:30.
You know what? The thing is right now, I'm sure like a lot of us are getting our sort of sea legs on being like having to work from home right now. And so like, well, I work at a bar and it's funny being like, I know how to drink controlled and in control of increments of time, but I also have to do this because I work at a bar, so it's like,
right, you gotta pace yourself. Know
yeah, when you're at home and you're working, the alcohol is always there, you have to figure it out. When you're at work and there's alcohol there, you have to figure out how to control it. So I have a lot of experience with this that I'm trying to apply, but it's okay if your first few days you've been like, oh, well, I could just drink whatever, right?
Yeah, time doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way you're going to feel for a while. But like at some point, whenever you're ready, set some rules for yourself. Because it does, it ultimately, like, nothing sucks more than like day drinking at 2 and being drunk by 6 and then waking up at like midnight and just confused. Like,
that's not good.
Just like, where, you know, you do your day, like have some structure. I don't know. It's hard right now.
I know, like, you are really good at having this structure. You got those rules for yourself. But like, I mean, I kind of take it day by day and decide what my rules for myself are each day.
See,
but I know that I would feel a lot better if I had, like, when I do take the time to like make a list or like decide what I'm going to do, then it feels a lot better. But you got a pretty good routine going on, don't you?
I do. I don't get up crazy early. I get up around like 9:30, but like I get out immediately and like I've always run like a 5K every day. Now I'm running a 10K every day. That's to make up for the fact that the rest, like, I'm trying to limit the amount of time I'm entering and exiting my building. Okay. So there's just that one trip out to run in the city and then the, you know, one trip back. But like, I get up, I run. Because I run, I'm sweaty, so that makes me take a shower every day. That's good. Yeah.
Yes.
And then after I get out of the shower, I have the opportunity to put on like daytime clothes, like functioning human clothes. Hey. And that's good too. And then if I need any supplies, I get them on the way back from the track. So it's like my, you know, my exit and entrance for my building is very contained to the one. And then I also have a reason to put on clothes. I've gotten my exercise for the day. I've gotten cleaned up. I've put on human clothes. I highly recommend it. Like, not everybody's in the same situation. Not everybody is, you know, I don't know, a running weirdo like I am. But, like, definitely design some sort of structure that, like, works in, like, cleaning rituals and grooming rituals. And, you know, and then I eat breakfast or lunch at that point after I get up and all that stuff. So, you know, it's a whole series of events that makes me function that takes up, like, 5 hours of my day.
That's good. That is good. You know, I mean, I know it like sounds like some obviously, like, folks out there, don't beat yourself up if it takes a while to get a routine, but I know it does like feel better in general once you can like establish some kind of normalcy, and that's like another way of kind of coping with the thing. My normalcy right now is I have been watching The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina nonstop.
I don't, like, the thing is, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think I'm ahead of the curve just because I already had like a certain amount of freelance and like commission work worked into my schedule. I already had days like that I had to learn that. Those of you that are just now being like, how do I have days that are just off endlessly? Like, you're gonna go through a period where it's like, what if I just watched all the shows and like ate all the food? And that's fine. If that's where you are, you know, when you get to that point where it's not like what you want to do, like, then try to salvage the schedule. But I don't know. The world's insane right now. Like, don't beat yourself up however you're coping. And if you're having some days where you're just adjusting to not having anything to worry about, that's actually kind of a good feeling. And it's okay to, like, be enjoying that. I know no one should be saying that right now, but that's actually okay.
It's like, take it as a pause.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good way of looking at it.
We'll recoup, you'll make plans, you'll get structure, and it's good to keep that in the back of your mind. But if that's not where you are now, enjoy your Sabrina.
It's really good. I mean, is this my second time trying to watch it? Because the first time I just couldn't. I'm going to say something
you
controversial,
couldn't.
But I also know that there are people out there who agree with me. I just find the character kind of annoying.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I like her better now. I like her a lot better now. But the first season, I just found her annoying. But I've come around. I like the whole thing. I get the style. Like, I understand the, like, stylistically the point and the genius of Riverdale. But I also like couldn't really watch that.
I get that. Well, yeah.
Sabrina now.
Trash. I don't think Sabrina is trash on the level that Riverdale is trash. I watch them both, to be fair, but, you know, I will say one thing. I mean, because Sabrina, the one thing, it's, I just recently started rewatching True Blood in all of this, like,
shit.
And I'm like, I didn't,
that's a deep
dive. Well, I forgot how horny it was, but then Sabrina's super horny too, and I'm like, what is this about, like, supernatural, like TV shows that they have to be horny? Like, I want to see the show that's like werewolves and vampires, where they're just like, yeah, I don't really, I'm trying to figure myself out. I'm not really like looking to bone right now. Like,
they're
like,
always
really?
Looking to bone. You're right.
Like, it's a bit of a stereotype. Like, oh, you're a vampire. You must be a total slut. It's like, what if you're not? Hello.
Right. Where are the asexual vampires?
It's just really like, I'm working on that. All right. I'm working on that story.
Yeah. Oh,
I got
okay.
That.
All right. Okay. We're waiting patiently.
All right. So what is our topic for this week? It's not sexy vampires. It's we're not going to talk about the pandemic, but we are going to talk about something that has come from the pandemic.
Xenophobia.
Which, yeah. Hey.
Racism.
Hey, what?
To kind of combat that. We are talking about Baijiu, which is a Chinese spirit.
Ah, because right now, like, I think we need to remember that this may have, we may have had the original cases in Wuhan, but it's COVID-19. That's the name of the virus. It's not the Chinese virus. It's not the Chinese flu. Fuck all that.
Right, because other coronaviruses have existed in the world before. And also, it, like, pandemic literally means it affects everyone. Doesn't care. It doesn't care who you are.
And at this point, a New Yorker in China would be more dangerous than a Chinese person in New York.
That is...
Let's be real. Oh,
that is true.
So, shut up with all that xenophobia and racism. We're going to tell you why Chinese drinking culture and Chinese spirits are cool and things you should be interested about.
Yeah.
So let's get into it.
Oh, yeah. So am I going to talk about Baijiu first?
I think you should. Go right ahead. Okay. I'm curious.
All right. So Baijiu literally translates into clear liquor. And the term covers a category of at least a dozen Chinese liquors made from grain. And it's considered to be China's national beverage. It's usually about 40 to 50% ABV, which is high.
It's strong.
Very high. And it's usually made from sorghum grains. Really just any of the grains that we call cereal grains. And like cereal grains are basically like, they're called that because they're a little sweet and you can make porridge from them. So that includes sorghum, rice, wheat, barley, millet, or Job's tears, which is another kind of chewy, nutty millet grain. And I guess it's shaped like a teardrop. And it's made using a special fermentation agent called Chu. Yes. It is spelled Q-U with like a long bar over the U, but it's pronounced Chu. And we've mentioned before that while it seems, speaking of fermentation, while most of the ancient world believed that fermentation was caused by magic, much of the brewing cultures of Asia may have already known a little bit about cultivating yeast on purpose, which brings us to the origins of Baijiu.
China is like long held as the originators of most of our distilling and brewing techniques, right?
Oh,
like they
had
the first traces of wine.
Right.
Sounds like they had some of the earliest fermentation.
Yeah, they found, archaeologists found like bottles that contained some kind of spirit from like at least from like 5,000 years ago. And also, I mean, they've, you know, we as really what we know about alcohol history, what we can prove is that is the stuff that's been written down, and who has better records? Like they've been keeping them for a while.
Yeah. We were still afraid of lightning and they were figuring out fermentation.
Pretty much. So in the Han Dynasty around 200 AD, they invented Chu. And what they would do is they'd leave damp grains in a warm place for about a month until it grows yeast and other microorganisms. And then they would mold the grains into either a ball or into bricks. And then this was before distillation was a thing, obviously, that came later. So the resulting spirit was actually huangjiu, or yellow wine. Remember how baijiu means clear spirit? Huangjiu means yellow wine because it's yellow. But alcohol, like you said, alcohol was around in China way before the technique that created Huangjiu. And it was used as a diplomacy custom by Chinese emperors and courts with friends and enemies. But then when Huangjiu comes around, the Taoists got their hands on it and they just like ran with it. So you even have like this secular battle between the Confucianists, who would teach moderation, and then the Taoists, who are all these artists and poets who basically they believed in finding enlightenment through drunkenness. So they seem fun.
So is this like a drunken master moment? Is this where we get that?
I guess so. There's like, so there's this famous poet, Li Bai. He's really, really like one of the most famous poets, and he's a famous Taoist poet. He wrote over 130 poems about alcohol, basically. And then I have a side story about him, and I don't know if this is I wrote this down and now I think maybe it's a bummer. I don't know.
No bummers right now, but go ahead and tell it. I'll tell it out.
So a little side story about Li Bai. Li Bai, the Taoist poet, he died trying to scoop the moon out of the river on the side of his boat. And he fell in and drowned because he was drunk on the boat. So he...
leave that in. That's kind of beautiful. I mean, that's tragic, but... Yeah. You know what? Right now, a lot of things weird seem beautiful. So I like, if I could die in half a poetic way as that, I'd be okay with
it. He was drunk and he was trying to scoop the moon.
Not shoot the moon. He was
trying to scoop it.
Just scoop it up and hold it in my hands. Yeah, oh, that's so kind of sweet. I love that. That is so beautiful. Yes. Thank you for that. Oh, you're welcome.
I didn't do it.
You're still here. Okay, that sounds like a weird way to tell somebody to F off forever. Go scoop the moon, you asshole.
That's kind of like in My Fair Lady when like Audrey Hepburn is marching away from Freddie and he's like, where are you going, Eliza? And she's like, I'm going to the river. What are you going to do there? I'm going to dig a hole in it. Like, you heard me.
Well, all right. So there's My Fair Lady quote for the episode.
I mean,
all right.
I guess
that's everyone needs one. Why not?
Okay, let me get back on track. All right. So obviously, when we're talking about baijiu, we're talking about a distilled spirit. So distillation. It is commonly accepted that when Genghis Khan brought the Mongol horde to Asia, he also brought with him a rock. And this is likely when distilling knowledge spread to Asia and the wider world, for that matter.
I don't want to interrupt you, but no, a rock, you mean a rock, the liquor, not...
Yes.
A rock.
No, he didn't. Rock. He didn't bring the country. I think at the time
or,
it probably would have been...
Or a rock. I don't know, either way.
No. No, I mean...
A rock is a spirit.
Yes, the spirit. The like one of the most ancient distilled spirits that we know of. So... That's one possible origin of distillation knowledge, but the jury's kind of out on that one. Like I said, some of the archaeological findings that came out of Asia suggest that distillation knowledge may have come about via trade routes during the Song Dynasty, or may have even been developed independently in China. In any case, with the new distillation knowledge, they distilled the essence of Huangzhou, and that potent spirit became known as Xiaozhou, or that translated means burnt wine. And that happened sometime during the Ming Dynasty, and that is what we call today Baijiu.
Oh, okay.
So it wouldn't be a true alcohol origin story if we didn't talk about the legends. And actually, as far as like Chinese alcohol history, we've got a few to choose from. As I mentioned before, alcohol was around China for a long time. We've talked about that. So before recorded history, even before recorded history, and that is saying something because of all the ancient civilizations, China's got records. They've got receipts.
They got receipts.
But so even before Huangzhou, we know that they were consuming a drink brewed from rice, honey, grapes, and hawthorn fruit. So where did that come from? Because that is the origin of all of the alcohol.
That sounds great.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah.
I'd eat that as a porridge. Porridge. That was a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that would have been about the time, right? So one story is of Edie, who was either the wife or the daughter of King Yu, King Yu is a really important figure in Chinese history and mythology because it was said that he had the power to control water bending.
Wait, what? Okay, are you sure? Look, I know we have no concept of time or space anymore, but did you confuse Chinese mythology with the last airbender?
No,
are you sure?
No, that was like that was his thing. Like, I mean, according to legend, King Yu. Yeah, no. I mean, it does sound. It's very like maybe that's where Avatar got the idea. I don't know.
All right. So he was a waterbender.
He was a waterbender, according to legend. And as the story goes, Edie was the first to make wine out of rice. But when she showed it to the king, he was afraid that a future king would become an alcoholic and lose the throne, so he banned it. But then when he died, his son, Chi, became king and lifted the ban. And then alcoholic beverages, that was when alcohol became richly integrated in both royal and ceremonial Chinese culture.
Hmm.
So that's one story. Sorry, I had to burp.
All right.
Excuse me. The other story credits Du Kong. And his story is that one winter, he cooked some sorghum grain and he put it inside a hollow tree for safekeeping, as you do when you're Du Kong, or a squirrel, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know. That seems like a safe place for things.
Yeah,
I don't
sure.
know.
Hide it in a tree. Why not? If it's your tree, nobody's coming on your land. I don't know.
It's a hidden tree. I feel like a lot of people are hiding things in weird places right now.
That's
we don't
true.
Know what's going to happen. We're all a bunch of baby hoarders.
Right.
Maybe a tree's a good idea.
Yeah,
hide it in a tree.
Yeah. Du Kong was a ancient hoarder. And he hid his grain in a tree, and then he forgot about it.
Oh.
Yeah, kind of
he
also.
He got that tree drunk?
Also like a squirrel, right? That's a thing
yeah.
that squirrels do. They, like, forget about their nuts, and they become trees. So spring came.
That sounds so much deeper than I know, like, the actuality of it. When you forget about a nut, sometimes it becomes a tree. Like, that sounds like it should mean something.
It does right? mean something. That is something that squirrels actually do. They bury so many nuts and they can't remember where they all are. So some of them become trees. So squirrels are planting trees all over the world.
Yeah, but it feels like it should be a metaphor for something deeper about personal development that I can't figure out right now. So we'll just move on.
Yeah, somebody get at us with that. So he forgot about his grains. He forgot about his tree grains. Spring came, and he noticed that the tree smelled really good.
Did it smell like some good times?
It smelled real good. So he cut it open, and he drank some of what he found inside.
The inside of the tree just turned into alcohol.
Yes. Yes.
That, all right. Okay.
So that is the story of Du Kong and him accidentally discovering how to make baijiu. And actually, what's interesting about both of these legends is they both take place during the Xia dynasty, which is around 2070 BCE, which, like, that's like 4,000 years ago, right? And civilization only started about 6,000 years ago. That's a long-ass time.
I had this on lock from the beginning.
Like, yeah, that's so long ago. I was just trying to say that it was like double the amount of years that we haven't been. I don't have anything to say there. It's not like it's like.
Well, look,
we know that there was years before our calendar. I don't know what I'm trying to say. It's a lot.
We're living in a time where a single day feels like a decade. So that seems especially long.
It's so long. 4,000 years is so long.
So long ago feels like Saturday. And I think it's Monday. I don't know.
Okay. So, bye, Joe. There are... So there's different flavor or like they're called different flavor categories or sometimes different fragrance categories. And there's 4 or 5 main ones, depending upon how you think of it. I'll come back to that later. But like here's I'm going to tell you about the main ones. Each baijiu is really made distinct by the chu. So, like, the fermentation agent, but, like, you know, and that includes the grains used as well as the process that they do.
Okay.
It's all going to be something different. So, the first one I want to talk about is called sauce. Saucy.
The sauce.
It is kind of what it sounds like.
You're going to tell us about the sauce?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you about my sauce.
Tell me about the sauce.
Yeah. So the sauce, it's like sauce, you know. It's kind of
what's in the sauce?
What's in the sauce? I'll tell you what's in the sauce. Okay, so it is kind of what it sounds like. It's savory, earthy, salty, and somewhat spicy. The flavor kind of resembles soy sauce.
Okay.
Yeah. It takes so it like very like, you know, this is basically like the what we think of as like umami flavor. Like that's to the max. It takes a lot of work to make, and it's fermented in underground pits. The brand that this category is most associated with is Moutai, which is a favorite of the state. It has actually, this specifically has been called China's national liquor. Actually, at one of Mao Zedong's state dinners, Henry Kissinger remarked, "If we drink enough Moutai, we can solve anything."
Probably.
I mean, it's like 100 proof, so sure. Maybe. Or maybe you'll start some more problems. Maybe we'll have different problems by the time we solve these ones. So the second one I'm going to talk about is called Strong. Strong is full-bodied, it's spicy, it's fruity, and it's fermented in earthen pits. And this is probably the most popular type of baijiu. I did like a little, since I couldn't taste all of these different ones when I was putting this together, I watched other people taste it.
And, oh, nice.
And these two, sauce and strong, are the ones that like people have the most severe reaction to. They're going to be, I mean, just like their names, obviously, the soy sauce flavored one is going to be its own thing. And then strong is what the name is strong. It tastes strong. There you go. The next category is light. It's called light. It tastes light, obviously. it's kind of floral. It's slightly sweet. It's fermented in ceramic jars. So it can be a little bit cheaper to produce and therefore more affordable. A popular varietal of this is Erguoto, which is very popular among blue-collar workers. And Red Star is the most popular brand of this type. Despite it being a light baijiu, it is usually still 100 proof. So it tastes light. It is not light. It is still full potency. The next one is rice, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's made from long grace or glutinous rice. It tastes light, clean, and honeyed. It can incorporate herbs, fruits, or tea leaves, and it usually has a soft, sweet flavor and a clean aftertaste. Now, the last one I'm going to mention, I mean, depending upon how you look at this, like, this is there are other, like, subcategories. There's like extra strong, and there's like one that's like it uses pork fat to like enhance the flavor in a way.
Weird.
There's a few other like subcategories, but then this category is called mixed, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's blended baijiu. So it's just made by blending two or more different baijiu's, and you're going to get something different because all the baijiu's taste different. So the possibilities are endless. You know, yeah. So there's like, from what I heard about the different flavor, or what I read about the different flavor profiles, like baijiu's can differ in taste and profiles, like as much as like as far as like gin is from whiskey, like it's like
right.
And everything in between. Yeah. It's not like, it's not really one, like if you've tasted one baijiu, you don't actually know what all, like, you don't know what all baijiu tastes like.
You know, you can say whiskey, but are we talking about white whiskey? Are we talking about unaged whiskey? Are we talking about aged whiskey? Are we talking about rye? Are we talking about bourbon?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
That's, you know, just to kind of put it in the wheelhouse, like, that's, whiskey is a big word that means a lot of things, and that's true for baijiu too, which, you know,
right.
I think I've only had a few kinds of baijiu in my time. I've tried the kinds that have tried to make a place for themselves in the American cocktail market. And everything that I've tried has been pretty, I don't want to say aggressive. I think people think that's a bad term. I don't mean it in a bad way. I feel like what I've liked about the baijiu's that I've tried are that they bring a lot of flavor to the table. And even if the flavors are completely different, it reminds me a lot of kind of the things I like about aggressive mezcals or like super herbal gins or aquavies. Like, I like a spirit that brings something to a table, to the table, and says, this is what it tastes like. Figure me out in a cocktail. Like, right. I, you know, like, vodka is like, I'm vodka. I'll go anywhere. Like, but baijiu is, from just the ones I've tasted, and as you said, like, absolutely, they can be a lot of different things. Like, it's a spirit that kind of brings an equation to the table. Like, here are the things I'm presenting. Balance me with what you have. And that's cool. Like, I like working with spirits like that. Way more than spirits just disappear in the glass or are super smooth, super palatable from the get-go. I kind of don't have any edges to, like, sand down with spirits like that. Like, you're just kind of highlighting the good parts of them. But when you have a spirit that has some funkiness or some weirdness or some fun, bright flavors, like, they're fun to work with. So
I really
enjoyed having it on the back bar, the few places I've had it.
Right. Well, I mean, it's going to be like, I'd say like anything that is 100 proof is going to be a little bit aggressive. And
yeah. Oh, yeah.
I like when I was watching like people try it on YouTube and like somebody remarked like, this is basically the Chinese Everclear. Well, no, it's not, because Everclear just tastes like a distilled spirit that we think of as being like super, super high proof. Like, we just think of it like tasting like pure ethanol. Right. But like, you're not going to get that with baijiu. You're going to get a flavor. Like,
yeah,
that's different.
So that's baijiu. I think it's a fun spirit. Like I said, like, it's a fun spirit to work with. If you come across it, there are a lot of brands that have made their way onto the American marketplaces recently. And it's, you know, it's just like any other spirit. You taste it, you figure out what it's made of, and you balance it out with your cocktail ingredients. It's really fun to work with. But what I want to talk about is the Chinese drinking culture and habits at large.
Okay.
So obviously, the first thought about Chinese drinking culture is, what are they drinking? As Liz told us all about, baijiu is a huge part of that. That is still the biggest selling spirit in their marketplace. But things are changing very recently, like in the last decade or so. There's been a very distinct shift in Chinese drinking habits. So I want to touch on that first, and then we'll get into some customs. But I think it's kind of cool. Like, so basically in the past, you had like the bulk of the people drinking were drinking at home or at like business dinners. It really was kind of not really about what you were drinking. It was more just about the customs around drinking. But as like the millennials take a big blame for this, not really a blame, but like, as you have a growing middle class, so we're talking about like, you know, late 20, early 30 year olds, like people in our age range have more money. They are, you know, they're being more experimental. They're trying new things. So they're creating like cultures around like beer and wine. French wine is like massively imported to China. Like, oh, it's shit. Been like almost to the, like, well, actually not almost, to the point that the rest of the world has had to redistribute like how they buy French red wine. Because China has bought so much of it with their growing middle class, they become these major players. But also, like, just China has a bigger import market in the past, like, decade or so than it had before that. It's allowing a lot of other spirits in, and people are developing palates for those. Like, brandy is huge on the Chinese market right now. Another big thing is, like, about 55% of, like, the drinking populace of China buys some, if not all, of their alcohol online. Like, there's a big internet, online international marketplace. This actually is a weird throwback to our Four Loko episode, where I couldn't figure out, like, why are so many Chinese people buying Four Loko online? This is
because they just, like, buy alcohol online.
They buy alcohol, yeah. So it's just another cool thing online. So it's really just like, it's a broadening of the marketplace. It's a lot of more young people sort of developing how the culture progresses. Even the cocktail culture. That's really the thing that I'm most interested in. If I should I ever get to leave New York City again, I would love to go to China. Some of the best bars in the world right now are in like Beijing and Shanghai. Like they have an amazing, very new but very aggressive, like cool cocktail culture that's coming from like the same group of people that have disposable income. They have a curiosity and they're changing the way that China drinks as a whole.
Nice.
Also, women are drinking more, and like that seemed like a weird thing for me to say, like women, like but it's true, like women are drinking more in China. They're demanding, like they prefer like lower alcohol things or you know, things that just aren't straight like baijiu. So it's really cool. It's a really kinetic, like changing marketplace right now as far as what people are drinking. That being said, there are still rules you want to follow that have been around for a long time. It's a lot of them are similar to what we've talked about with Korea and Japan, like their drinking cultures.
Okay.
But maybe you didn't listen to that episode. There's still some nuances that are different. I'm going to go into them.
All right. I'm excited. I like to know what the rules are. It's nice when like they have rules and you get to just follow them and you know what they, and everybody knows what this means and you're supposed to do this at this time. It takes a lot of the stress out of social interactions, you know?
I love it. I love rules applied to drinking because I feel like in America, it's kind of like, if you're drinking, you're doing something bad, so you shouldn't be doing it. So just, you're just bad.
Right.
But like, I like these cultures that are like, no, there's a right way to do it. Like you could do it in a respectful way. Like, I appreciate that.
Yeah. It also makes it kind of like a game.
Yeah.
You could think of it that way.
Did you win? Well,
did
yeah,
I win?
So
I did everything right. Did I win? What do I win?
You win respect in your community.
Yes!
That's yeah.
Yes.
I never win respect after after drinking. Never. But that is really key. Like, it's not just about relaxation in China. It's an important part of their social and business interactions. And why is that? I mean it's. It's an opportunity to prove yourself, your prowess and your strength, like quite literally how much you can handle. It's an opportunity to prove your respect for those around you, your ability to like humble yourself, to recognize your status and also recognize those that are above you. It's also just a chance to say like, hey, I'm willing to get a little loose and speak more plainly and more openly with you, which would reveal my true self, so you know you can trust me.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, drinking to excess, well, and that's the thing, like drinking to excess for the sake of a party, you're saying like, look, I'm willing to take whatever happens to me tomorrow morning for the team. So it's integral to societal bonding.
That's beautiful.
And that's something we've seen. Like, we've seen that in Japanese culture. We've seen that in Korean drinking culture. And this is echoed again in Chinese culture. And, But, like I said, there are specific rules to it. So, obviously, the best place to start is with the cheers.
What do they say?
Ganbei, which is actually very similar to what they say in Korea.
Oh, yeah. What was the Korean cheers?
I believe it was also Ganbei.
It was Ganbei? Who says, it's Japanese.
Kanpai
is Kanpai.
Japan, yeah. So Ganbei literally translates to dry cup. And it's at parties, it's important to empty your glass when that toast is called for. Now, there are different, like, there are nuances there. Like, Banbei is a toast that means, like, drink half your glass. Ganbei, drink it down. Banbei, like, maybe we're all a little too messed up. How about you just drink half? So there are levels there, but Ganbei in its origin means drink your glass up. And that is a sign of respect. Finishing your drink in the moment is a sign of respect. So that's important to note. Now, if somebody proposes a toast to you, it's important to propose a toast in response, especially if they're your superior or on a similar status level to you. And that's Jingzhou is the like the term for like to propose a toast. And that like you offer a toast back to them and to anyone in your surrounding that has a similar status or a superior status to you. If you're at a massive party, it's okay to like group people together a little bit. So okay. You're not, because the reason that matters is because if you're the one proposing the toast, you definitely have to finish your drink.
Oh, like, shit. Okay. Yeah. So you definitely want to kill, well, not kill birds with stones. We don't do that on this show.
No, we don't.
But, you know, feed three birds with one scone.
Yes. So you have to, if you're the one offering the toast, you got to finish your drink. So yeah. For extra points, using two hands. I think we talked about this when we were talking about Korea. Two hands is important. Using your right hand to hold the glass and your left hand underneath of the cup as a way of toasting your drink. That's a good way to do it. And even like after your toast, you might want to tip your glass a little bit to the person who's receiving the toast to show that you drank your drink. So there's a big emphasis on finishing your drink out of respect. Now, that being said, if the receiver of the toast does not finish their drink, that's not a sign of disrespect to you. If that's your senior or somebody on a similar level to you, they don't have to finish their drink. They probably will, because it sounds like a lot. There's a lot of pressure here, like from the culture to everybody.
You don't
everybody
have
drinks.
To. No pressure. Yeah. But there is pressure.
There's even a toast that's like, Wo gagne ni suye. I definitely butchered that. But the translation is, I would drink it all, but you don't have to.
Like, and that's, I would, if it were me, I'd do it.
Like that's basically like, it's a toast to basically like, look, I'm definitely gonna drink this because I respect you, but I respect you so much that I don't expect you to finish your drink.
But you could. I'm gonna do it.
Yeah,
that's how much I respect you.
Right. So you know, I think the safe bet, if I have to call it safe bet, is to just finish your drink every time, but obviously that's not possible. These are, you know, these drinking parties.
Anything's
and everybody is,
you know. Maybe do they pour it in a smaller glass, maybe?
Well, I mean it's not, this is a big difference between like Western and Eastern drinking culture, is there's less emphasis on what you're drinking and more how you're drinking. So you could be drinking beer and be asked to drink like a little glass of beer while you're co-workers are drinking baijiu or wine.
All right.
So
when did we talk about it was Korean culture, right, where everybody has to drink the same thing in each round?
Oh yes,
or was
that's right.
That Japanese?
That was Japanese. That was Japanese culture. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. In Japanese culture, it's a bit more about like drinking. Like it's not. Yes, in Japanese culture, you kind of want to drink the same thing. But here, it's not as much about what you're drinking. It's more how you're drinking and that you're drinking together.
Okay.
So
like
if you're really worried about getting messed up, maybe start with beer and stay with beer. A lot of Chinese beers are like pale lager or pale ales or lagers, so they're a little lighter.
Nice.
So that's a choice. So that's the toast. We've got you through that. So we talked about this in other cultures. I thought this was a good note. As far as refilling other people's glasses go, it's polite, but it's not necessary. You may refill your own glass, and in fact, you should before another toast is proposed. So you should always be ready for somebody to toast you.
Always ready.
So you may pour your own drink. And if you want to offer it to other people, that is definitely polite and respectful, but you are allowed to pour your own drink. Glass clinking. There's a lot here similar to stuff we talked about before. At big parties, you'll see people just tap their glasses. It's not like everybody toasts together because that takes too long. But should you be offered like a glass to glass toast, you should be aware of your status.
Oh, because you have to hold it at different places.
Yep. The lower ranking person, you should lower your rim of the glass below your superior. Now this kind of becomes like a sort of a playful back and forth. Like if it's somebody of a similar rank, you'll go back and forth, try to lower the rim of your glass until you hit the table. So then you're just toasting the table.
So you are doing, it's like a contest of politeness.
Yes, it is. It's like, oh, no, I'm below you. No, I'm below you. No, I'm below you.
Oh, my God. I love that. I thought you were, okay, so I didn't think that that's where you were going when you first said that. I thought it was going to be like a way you can snub someone or like send a secret, like, I'm coming for you message. Just like, put your glass higher. But no, it's the opposite because they're so right. damn polite.
Well, and I mean, I think that that's, it's that, but I also thought it was interesting that a couple of the articles I read noted that if you're definitely, if you outrank somebody, and this is even true, like, it's not just for business, like, dinners, it's for families as well. Like, if you're definitely the superior, you don't want to necessarily try to lower your glass to somebody who's younger than you or your subordinate. Because it looks like false modesty.
Oh, so if which your position is impolite.
Exactly. So there's kind terrible. Of a weird like tango here of like, it's good to be like, oh, no, I'm not above you. But yes, I am. Actually, yes, I am. Like, you don't want to appear like you're not aware of your status.
Okay. So the name of the point of the game is what you win is you get respect. But the way you play the game and the game is who is the most polite.
And I love that. I'm all about that. I think I'm just saying this as an American. I wish more of our customs were around who was more polite right. to each other.
Right. I mean, I'm like, I don't know. This is definitely a me problem, but I start to get aggravated when people are too polite. Like, you know, when they're like, when somebody like insists that you go first. I get so frustrated with that because I'm like if like it's like somebody like when I see somebody who I would consider like a more like a senior citizen, like I'll try to motion that like, oh no, we're after you. And then like I always get in this weird like. They'll be like after like not it's not always a senior citizen, but you know what I mean, like when you get into that tango with somebody of like, oh yeah. no after you, oh no after you, oh no after you, I'm like, we need to get on the bus now, okay? I'm just gonna go.
Well,
and
okay,
I look like a butthead because I didn't keep playing the politeness game. But I love that a culture is around that and that is what they are about, and I wish that I had the patience for that, I guess is what I'm saying. I don't have good patience.
I mean, I feel like it's gotta be a practice song and dance. Like, people okay. know their status, they just know what they're expected to perform in okay. front of people. Like, that's what I would assume. It's kind of like, I know you're like, maybe we're at the same job but you're a little older than me or a little bit more experienced, so I know like I should take the lower position, or like, yeah, I'm a little bit higher on the ladder than you. I'm not going to call it out, so we'll go back and forth for a minute. But I'll take the loss. Like, I feel like it's what I like about this stuff is it's. I mean, I don't know if I like it. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
That it's about establishing respect for each other through these series of motions. Like, it's about recognizing, like, I know where you are as opposed to me, or like, I respect you. Like, it's a way of signaling, and I think that's why it's so tied to these, like, the business cultures,
Yeah.
These drinking rituals where it really is like we're pulling down our boundaries so we don't have that soberness that says I'm going to say whatever I need to say to like make you happy. It's like I'm kind of without my guards and now I'm just operating manually and I'm asked to show you respect repeatedly. And that's actually an important thing to note is that one of the big no-nos is that drinking is, it sounds like this is a lot of drinking and it is because you're expected to empty your glass most times, like, you know, there are a lot of toasts, but drinking on your own, like just kind of like sipping or downing your drink on your own is a little bit like not okay. Like it's supposed to be a group activity. So if right. you're just like, I don't want to finish my wine, I'm going to like and drink it on my own time and not take part in your toasts. Like that's not okay. It's a group thing. It's a way of signaling. It's a communication within your people.
Together. Yeah. I don't know the rest of the rest.
Well, that's not to say that you have to. That's not to say that you have to endlessly drink all the time. One thing about the glass clinking is that's Like, if you're clinking glass to glass, that's kind of like engaging the ganbe, the, like, you know, drink it up, dry cup thing. If you don't want to do that, you want to, like, have a polite way to say that, you can actually tears your knuckles to their glass.
Aw.
And that's kind of your way of respectfully asking to take it slow.
It's like drinking sign language.
Yeah, it is. And it's not necessarily always going to be paid attention to. Some people will still take that as a, no, 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 drink it up. But, like, that is a subtle way of being respectful and just saying, like, I would like to sip this, but I am engaging in your toast. Yeah. But then again, like I said, if you're offering, you don't have that option. If you're the one making the toast, you got to drink your glass up.
Because you made your bed. Got to lie in it.
Another interesting thing is if you're late to dinner, you're going to have to make up for that. I kind of love this. It's like if you show up to dinner party late and everybody else is two or three glasses ahead of you, you better be prepared to catch up.
Oh, wow.
It's culturally acceptable and encouraged. It's penance. So, yeah, and, you know, once again, like, if you don't drink, it doesn't mean you can't take part in, you know, Chinese drinking culture or the business culture that this is a part of. It really just means that you want to let that be known up front.
Okay.
Obviously, if you're ill, if you're driving, if you're pregnant, women get exempt from this a lot. I don't know. But you can get out of it. You just want to make that clear from the beginning, because it is rude to drink sporadically, to skip toast, to drink just a little. Like,
right.
The point of it is the group bonding.
Okay. It's like, if you were to do that, it would be kind of like signaling that, like, I'm not part of this. Like, and that seems kind of snobby. Like, I'm not one of you, kind of.
Especially if I mean, in these circumstances, this is not going out with some friends you have in China. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about, like, these kind of structured, like, group outings, business outings. Like, in these situations, you're just as much having a good time and drinking and eating as you are proving who you are. Your ability to be respectful, your ability to be strong, your ability to be consistent. Like, there are all these, and we've talked about these in other cultures. It's kind of cool. Like, I would pass that interview way better than most interviews, I feel like. But
I mean, well, that's the other thing. It's like, if you know the structure and you know what to expect, and you can, it's really nice that, like, they have these nonverbal signals and they have this structure and these cues to basically, like, be really clear about that, like, without having to come out and say it. But it's like, we all know what this means,
right?
Like, I think that's really cool.
And I think the important takeaway is, because there seems like a lot of nuances here that could make people be like, oh god, that I'd be afraid. I think the important takeaway is that there is a level of respect that's expected, that you could always meet with, you know, hey, I want to be respectful in the situation. What's the best way to do this? In the instance of, you know, you being out with friends or with a group of coworkers in a foreign country, I think it's always just important to ask, because people will always be happy to tell you, like,
yeah, nobody's gonna be mad at you for asking.
Yeah,
especially if your goal is that you're trying to be polite and you're trying to be respectful.
That's cool. I think that's I love that. I love the idea of having that kind of, we know we're gonna cut it up a bit. We're gonna get kind of sloshed, but, like, we're kind of following some sort of social guidelines.
Yeah,
I think that's not a thing. That's not a concept we have here in America, at least. I don't know about the rest of the Western world, but definitely not here.
Yeah.
Ish.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's like, that's the thing. I think that when you don't have it, like, if you aren't purposeful with having kind of, I mean, like, that, like, I'm, it's literally what you were talking about with, like, everyone being part of the group. Like, it is all, we're all in this together,
right?
Like, it is definitely like the bond, like, when drinking is about bonding and about being in community with people, then really all the things that we have in Western culture, all the things that we have, like, specifically in American culture, that are, like, shameful about that, like, No, it's about being with people. Like, it's it's always been really about community. It's just been turned into, it's been stigmatized because it's also been used in this other way as like a coping mechanism. And maybe if those, the people who have felt like they had needed to use it that way, felt like they were part of a community, then they wouldn't have used it like that.
Well, that,
I don't know.
I agree. No, I think, back to what you were talking about, the origins of Baijiu, it's like the idea that there was, you know, a lot of thought behind drunkenness is sort of an important part of, like, revealing yourself to yourself, or like, like, understand. Like, I, there are a lot of cultures that have that in their backbone, and I think that that's what the modern evolution of that is exactly what we're talking about, where it's sort of in vino verita, you know, it's in wine there is truth, in we reveal ourselves and we become vulnerable, but then we also can forge deeper connections, which I'm not saying that's the only way to do that. I'm not even encouraging that, you know, that's always a good thing, but I do think that there's a thought there that's a little bit, it's less damning on, you know, alcohol consumption. And I think, I don't know. I think it's cool. I think that there's culture there. It's cool.
It is cool.
We're gonna figure out how to make you some Baijiu cocktails over on the YouTube video. Order some Chinese food, because the thing is, I mean, just like, I have a bunch of random immigrants that came to this country to make me here, and just because they all happen to be mainly white people doesn't make me more American than a Chinese American that's been here. Like, it's really fucking crazy that I hear these stories about like racism against Chinese people right now, like xenophobia against Chinese people. Like, let's fuck Melania, but let's be better.
Like, right. Oh my God. Like, let's yeah, I mean, I think that's like, that goes right along with what we're talking about with the history of Baijiu and the culture, the drinking culture that we're talking about is like more now more than ever, like, we are literally all in this together. You know, if you can order from a Chinese restaurant, do that. If you are especially if you're like in cities where like a lot of what we consider grocery stores are also like bodegas and delis and like our local like marts, like if you can shop at your like Asian markets, like, and they have everything. That's the thing. Like that's when we're worried about grocery stores running out of supplies, running out of like toiletries, like they have everything.
Yeah.
And like they're experiencing, they're going through enough because they're going through the same thing everyone else is going through. And then they have to deal with racism on top of it. Like, that's not cute. That's not fair.
When we talk about the history of alcohol, when we talk about drinking culture, the America has fuck nothing to contribute when it comes to the innovation, how to distill, how to ferment, how to make things. We didn't. You could say we made whiskey or bourbon. Like, that's kind of true, but that was knowledge brought over from, you know, the Scottish, the Irish.
Yeah. And when we're talking about America, we're talking about what we know as the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, because then once you get, like, you know, south of the border, like, there were corn spirits that were already being made.
Of course.
You know, like, every spirit that has been brought to this country has been brought on somebody else's shoulders from some other country. Our culture, the thing that America has contributed to the world of drinking, the world of mixology, is that we were the first people to really popularize cocktails. And I want you to really think about what that means. We didn't make the good stuff. We just figured out how to mix it together to make even better stuff. That's the core of us. So once we start, like closing off our borders or shitting on things that have come into this country, the cultures that have fed us, we lose what goes in that fucking mixing glass. And that's that's who we are. There's no we. We're the rest of the world. We all just came here. So,
yeah,
you know, if you want to be a xenophobic piece of shit, like, you don't get to eat the food and drink the drinks that have come from the rest of the world.
Which is everything, really.
It's everything.
That's everything.
Apple pie? No, that was Germany. Like, hot dogs? No, I think that was also Germany. Vermouth, France, Italy, aperitifs, digestives, tequila, like, you know,
right.
any sort of grain distilling technique. Most of this dates back to China, as we talked about. It all kind of dates back to there. They're the originators of most of this knowledge. So, like, just, you know, you can't disrespect the people and enjoy the knowledge that they gave you. You just can't. Or you can, but if you do, you're a fucking asshole.
Yeah, really.
There, I'll get you. Okay. Dismount.
No, that was good. That was very good. I'm not cutting that out. I won't.
you can trim it. This is verbose.
I might trim it, but I'm going to keep that. So a few people that I want to talk to that are for sure not assholes I want to thank all of our Patreon members, everybody who joined us on our live stream and everybody who watched it after. It was really cool. And it felt really nice to have like a little community in that moment. And you guys are really just like hanging in there. We really appreciate you. Thank you to everybody who's upped their membership. Like, we didn't ever expect that, and we don't expect that of you, but that is really lovely and generous of you. And as well as to all our new Patreon members. We are working on getting rewards out. So just be patient with us. We're going to figure out what that is, just like we're figuring out what it means to be recording this remotely. We're not really sure when exactly, what day this week we're going to get the video out, but we are going to come up with something for you, so don't worry, that's in the pipeline too. Yeah. But if you want to join our Patreon and help us out a little bit, we will put the link in our show notes. Thank you to everybody who's been tweeting. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoostCast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe. That helps us a lot in the ratings. And while you're there, you know, rate, give us a review if you like. And you can like, follow, subscribe, all that good stuff on whatever platform you're listening to.
I have been Taylor Sparrow.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been Neat.